Radio Show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time here on UCY.TV Radio. We relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision Radio Show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear.
Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Fission radio show. Today is March 9th, 2017. The year marches on, as they say. It's 8 o'clock in the morning here on the West Coast. Thank you for joining our radio show, and thank you for sharing our podcast and our station with other people. You know, as you know, we're a small, expanding radio show, so we do rely on you to share our station with other people. Today, we have on the air with us Tony West, who is the producer of a very compelling film, which frankly I've watched several times, called The Safe Side of the Fence. Tony, thank you for joining us. I feel very honored to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me on, Lonnie. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, I'm very grateful that you came and are sharing your time with us. Your film, The Safe Side of the Fence, is about what has gone on in St. Louis and what is ongoing in St. Louis, which is that people in St. Louis are living next door to a nuclear burning dump site, essentially. So why don't I ask you, well, first off, let me just introduce you. You're not a filmmaker by profession, are you?
No, this is the first film I've ever made, actually. And I started off doing network news for like NBC, ABC, CBS. I've always been a freelance contractor type person. And then I kind of drifted off into sports. And so I do a lot of major league sports for Major League Baseball, NFL, NHL. So if you're a sports person and you're watching a baseball game on television, we use multiple camera angles, and I'm one of the camera operators that's operating the camera that you might be watching.
Okay.
If you're looking at the World Series or whatever.
So that's how you knew how to do the film. The film, by the way, is excellent. I highly recommend it. I've watched it probably four times on Amazon Prime. I got it on Amazon Prime. It comes with my subscription, so that's super awesome, because I have watched it repeatedly, to be honest. Many of my listeners know I'm really drawn to this issue about St. Louis, and your film goes in depth not only about the story and the catastrophe, but you really do bring it home in terms of a human level with the people that you have interviewed. How did you find these people? That's what I wondered. Like, the depth of these people's knowledge and their willingness to talk was very compelling for me. How did you find them?
Well, I found a lot of the workers through Denise Brock, who is featured in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Denise Brock is a woman whose parents were workers at Mallinckrodt, and I guess I give you a little background about Mallinckrodt first, and then I can just kind of go into it. So I guess my story pretty much starts back during World War II, when you know, the United States decides that, hey, we need to build a bomb before the Germans build one. And before they could really assemble a bomb, they really had to figure out how to control a self-sustained chain reaction, basically control the splitting of the atom. And in order to do that, Enrico Fermi was going to do this test in Chicago with the Chicago pile, which was the first reactor. And they needed someone to refine tons of uranium. Nobody had really ever done that before, and they looked at a lot of larger companies around the United States, and nobody really wanted to take that job on. It felt like it was a dangerous job, or they were too busy, or whatever. And so a small pharmaceutical company in St. Louis called Mallinckrodt Chemical Works decided to take the job on. And they were very good at it, and they refined the uranium and sent it up to Chicago, and the Fermi's test was successful, and they went to Los Alamos and developed the did the Trinity test, and Mallinckrodt started to supplying the refined uranium for that test too, and of course dropped the bomb in Japan, and the war ends, but then the Cold War begins. And since Mallinckrodt was very good at refining that uranium, they continued doing that, and throughout the Cold War they built another plant in Weldon Spring, and we'll talk about that. But essentially the workers who worked at that downtown Mallinckrodt plant became some of the most contaminated workers in the history of the nuclear industry, because those workers really weren't protected. They were working in an environment that wasn't designed to do this kind of work, and they didn't really have a health and safety person show up into 5 years after a lot of people had already been working with the material. So it became this, in my mind, kind of this test site where here were workers for the first time doing this type of work on this large scale and getting really contaminated, and just, I don't want to say using them as guinea pigs, but basically watching what would happen to these workers as they became ill.
Science really, experiments, really.
Yeah, you know, and when I found that out, I obviously it was very upsetting, because first of all, I grew up in St. Louis, and I didn't know. I've heard of Mallinckrodt, but I had no idea what their connection was to the Manhattan Project. So, and then I didn't really think of workers being kind of just used as almost tested upon, you know. I didn't realize how reckless they were treating workers as far as safety.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I met Denise Brock is a woman whose parents worked at Mallinckrodt, and one of the situations, it wasn't just Mallinckrodt here. You had Oak Ridge, Tennessee, Hanford. You had a number of sites, Los Alamos. Mm-hmm. You had a number of sites where workers were getting contaminated. It wasn't just St. Louis.
Right.
I don't want to imply that it was just us. And so, essentially, the government came out with a program. It's a compensation program called the Energy Employees Occupational Illness Compensation Program Act, which is a ridiculously long name, very difficult for people to remember, or even.
What do they call it? What's the acronym for that? Energy Occupation?
The Energy Employees Occupational Illness Compensation Program Act. So it's the EEOICA.
ICPA. Wow.
Yeah, ICPA.
Yeah, make it so that nobody can remember what the name of it is. If you want to try to get funds, you got to remember the name. That's your first. That's your first cross to bear, right?
Cross to bear, and then you have to qualify for this program. And so essentially, the program was set up for weapons workers only. I mean, we're not making a lot of weapons right now. So if you're doing nuclear power or nuclear medicine, you don't really qualify for this program. And so that's another separate issue.
But say that again. I beg your pardon. So
yeah,
if you're not working in the right program.
This was for weapons work, doing the Manhattan Project in the Cold War, weapons work.
Wow.
That's what this program is set up for. So Denise Brock sees this program on television, and she just saw a news story or something about the program. I guess this probably was maybe 15 years ago or something like that when she sees the story about it, and she figures, hey, my parents worked at Mallinckrodt. I think at the time her mom was still alive. If the worker is deceased, the family can get the compensation. So she applies for the program, and she realizes how complicated and how many hoops she has to jump through, and it's very frustrating. So I kind of document Denise Brock's steps of trying to go through this program to get compensated. And so one of the things that I wanted to look at was, because I kind of break the film into two parts.
Can I ask you a question before we get into how you did it? What compelled, I mean, you're not a filmmaker by trade. You're a sports camera guy, right? That's really
everybody,
it. So what compelled you to put this together? Because this is a very compelling, excellent, excellent film, by the way. I mean, I literally have watched it at least five times. The reason I'm watching it so much is I'm attempting to remember everybody's names, but what's happening, I noticed over the weekend when I watch it again, because it's the names are kind of all getting mixed up. I get engrossed in the story. Like, I still am not emotionally detached enough to remember the names. Like, this is a very sad story for me. This is very, very hard and very sad, and it's an ongoing tragedy. So, but what compelled you to make this?
Well, it's essentially, I met three workers at a plant over in Venice, Illinois, even before I even knew about Mallinckrodt. Basically, there were three workers who, they were two of which are in the film. They were all about the same age. They all worked in the same plant. They all had cancer. But one of them had been compensated through this program, this Energy Employees Occupational Illness Compensation Program Act, and the other two hadn't. And so the two who hadn't were like, what about us? And I said, I don't know about you. I don't know. I've never heard of that program before in my life. I don't even know what it is. And I don't even know what kind of – so that's where it started. Just like, I'll look into this program, try to figure out what it is, because it seems like, you know, you guys should get compensated. And so that's what started it. So I started asking them questions about what they were doing in that plant. Why were they handling this materials? It was a former Dow Chemical plant. Dow Chemical initially ran this plant when they were
working
there.
Is this Larry Bergen's plant? Is this Larry Bergen's
Yeah,
plant?
Larry Bergen would – he would come there after, I think, a lot of the workers that I would talk to. He's kind of a – he's younger.
Okay.
Younger generation.
So it's not the same case. It's not Larry Bergen's case, because we've interviewed him on our show. So this is people that worked there prior to when Larry was.
I think Larry Bergen's in my film also, but that plant's been there a long time. So there's guys who work in there, you know, I think these gentlemen were up in their 60s and 70s when I interviewed them. And so it basically, they were subcontractors for Mallinckrodt.
Okay.
And that started me looking at Mallinckrodt.
Okay.
And that's when I learned the history of Mallinckrodt. So I was like, okay, you know, it was almost like you were peeling back an onion. And so it just kept getting layer after layer. And then once I discovered Mallinckrodt, I met Denise Brock, because you can't, you know, once the history of Mallinckrodt comes up, all paths lead to Denise Brock, because she's a very significant person. A lot of nuclear workers know who she is, because she's helped, you know, a number of people. She's made a huge impact. And when you see the film, you'll probably ask yourself, why isn't this woman famous? You know, why isn't this woman more known? But essentially, once we met her, and we started looking into the history of Mallinckrodt downtown, and then it kind of led to looking into the Weldon Spring plant, and then it kind of led to, like, the waste that's still out there. And you know, in my film, you see footage of workers cleaning up waste from the Manhattan Project, which was like 70 years ago. And
right.
I couldn't believe, you know, I was standing there recording people cleaning up Manhattan waste at this point. I just assumed that had been taken care of by now.
Yeah.
But you really, you can't really ever really completely take care of it, because when you dump material someplace, it's there. You know, it's going to be
right.
there for practically forever. You can do it, you can clean up as much of it as you can, but there's probably always going to be quite a bit of it around. And I guess what really, you know, you asked me why, you know, what really drove me into this. I worked on this film for 5 years of my life.
Wow.
And it, because I had to do it around my
work,
paying
yeah.
job. Yeah, I was just doing this on, you know.
And the rest of
the
your
side.
Life, yeah.
Yeah, and you have things that you're trying to do, and trying to do all this research because you want to get everything, you want to get all your facts right in a story like this, because, you know, you know,
mm-hmm.
people are looking at it, you know, you're dealing with multi-billion-dollar corporations, you know, who, you know, probably don't like how they look in the film, so you just want to make sure you document everything and just make sure everything is factual, and that takes time, just going
well,
through.
Thank you for taking that time. The fact that you took your time and made it correct is the reason why I can find it on Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
I mean, thanks. If it was a fly-by-night film, Amazon would have never put it up there like that if the facts hadn't have bared true.
That's true. It's also on iTunes, too, if people don't have Amazon. It's also on iTunes.
And the name of the film, again, let's just say it again, is The Safe Side of the Fence.
The Safe Side of the Fence. Yeah, it's a long name. And
it's a
when
good
you see
name.
The film...
And, yeah, tell them how that came about, because that's the opening scene. Well, let's get back to how you got into this, and then let's get into how you named it. But finish
okay.
up how you got into, like, what compelled
well, I
got,
you. Well, I really started getting into it because when I met these workers... I mean, it just they're just really kind people. You know, you invite me into their house and sit me down. It's like, hey, can I make you a sandwich or get you some lemonade or whatnot? And it's just really
sweet.
Nice people that you just, you know, kind of just bond with. And it's almost like you're talking to your grandparents or something. And you want to help them. And I just felt like, how can I help these people? I'm not a rich person. I'm not a famous person. But I do have some television equipment, and I know how to how to shoot, you know, and I know how to edit. And so I think what I will do is I will just try to get these people's story out, and that's what I tried to do. And because there are so many workers who, first of all, there are workers themselves who qualify for this program who don't know about the program. I've been in 19 different cities with this film at this point, and in March, on the 29th, I'm going out to the Bay Area with the film at the Vine Cinema. I'll be out there on the 29th. And that'll be the 20th city that I've been to. And when I go to these different cities, workers show up and they say, I never heard of this program. And, you know, I have a sponsor, Nuclear Care Partners, is sponsoring me to come out there. And they'll be there to pass out information, and usually they'll sign people up on the spot, you
wow.
know, for these people, they qualify. The government set this money aside for these workers, and they're not, you know, they're not on television every day advertising this program, saying, "Hey, everybody, you know, if you qualify for this program, you can get in here."
If
no,
you work
you
on the Manhattan Project, come and get your money. In other words,
come,
that's
yeah.
really essentially it.
Exactly. Come and get your money. And so people are sick out there and they're suffering. If you get through this program, you know, you get a medical card too, which helps. I mean, because people, you get cancer, it's really going to be very costly, and people are running through their savings, and family members are
right.
trying to help. And
right.
and basically, really what I've really found, Lonnie, what I've really found when I've spoken with these workers and I'm interviewing them, they're very patriotic.
Right.
I mean, they went to work every day to protect this country, and we didn't protect them. And they're not super bitter about it, but what frustrates them is being denied in this program. That's kind
mm-hmm.
of a slap in the face to them, you know, because the least you can do, I think they see the program as, you know, the government admitting, hey, I wronged you, basically. I made a mistake, and I'm going to compensate you. So when they go through their paperwork and jump through all these hoops, and they get denied, it is a double slap in the face to them. And so one of the things I wanted to do with this film, I wanted to do two things with the film. One, I wanted to focus on this program, make sure people know about it so it doesn't get cut, and expand the program. And people are falling through gaps in this program. I'm glad there is a program, but there needs to be a lot of work done, because there's situations where they will look at a secretary and say, well, you were a chemical worker, you're a secretary, but yet she's walking through the same plant, breathing it, contaminated.
Right.
Yeah. And so things like that, or you were a subcontractor instead of a contractor directly with the government, and you know, all these different like little things where it's catching people up. I like to see that thing focused on. And then also what I wanted to do was I wanted to make the public aware of all this waste that's being dumped out there. And let's just be honest. If I had done a film just about nuclear workers, I think it wouldn't have reached as many people, because I think people would say, you know, people tend to care about what affects them directly. And so people would say, well, I'm not a nuclear worker. I don't even know anybody who's a nuclear worker. Click, and they went. it may not be that much attention to it, but what I try to show in the film, it's not just nuclear workers. There are people in my film who aren't nuclear workers,
right.
at all. But the material finds its way into their workplace,
right?
And it can find its way into your workplace, and
it has.
And so people are, you know, living next to contaminated sites. And then they're not aware of it. And even if they are aware of it, then they have an uphill battle to get anybody to listen to them and clean it up. Or if they have people who are sick around the area, they have a super uphill battle to get anyone to admit, okay, yeah, that's probably from this waste that's over here. Because one of the things I wanted to just show in the film is there is a compensation program for workers. It needs work, but there is at least a program. It's a situation where they have admitted, we got these workers sick, we're going to try to do something about it. Mm-hmm. Now, imagine, and then you see in the film, even after all that, all these people getting denied and how hard they're fighting. You know, so I just wanted people to know, if you live next to some contaminated site and the government, you know, what are your chances going to be compared to these workers who they've already admitted they don't want to pay them? And that's why people are getting frustrated. They're like, well, why haven't they cleaned this up? Or why haven't they done this? Or why aren't they paying attention to me and my, you know, I live in this area and I'm sick. They're not even paying attention to these workers that they have a compensation program for. So, I mean, there's a lot of work that needs to still be done. There needs to be more, for me, in my opinion, needs to be a lot stiffer penalties for people dumping waste in certain areas, because it's basically what's happening. People will get a contract, a company will get a contract, and they'll say, I'll take care of that waste and dispose of it correctly for you, and then they just dump it someplace. And there's just, and the public ends up paying to clean that up.
And there's no penalty, really. The people who make those decisions to dump it, like, that's a criminal act. There's no penalty for the criminal acts. I mean, it really is an act against humanity, in my view. That's the thing in your movie. This is why I have to keep watching it, because I'm such an emotional character. Like, I keep getting drawn into the stories and the heartbreak of these people. Like, they're just shocked at how they're not... They're so innocent. They keep going in thinking, someone's going to help me. And then all of a sudden, it's like they have to fight to be helped. It's
horrible. It's horrible.
It is.
When you first of all, cancer is one of the worst diseases you can get, obviously. It's horrible. And when somebody is going to work, you just want to believe that they're being protected, that people are actually taking precautions.
Yeah.
You know, and if somebody comes up to you and they say, hey, you know, like Gary Ferguson in the film, hey, my nose just won't stop bleeding. My nose has been bleeding. It's basically shut up or you just won't be working here. That's the wrong
attitude.
You know,
that's the shock. Yeah. Well, not only that, but you know what? This is, I mean, I, I read on my YouTube channel Dr. John Goffman's work, and I say this repeatedly because he, one of the first books I read by his, he said that basically the U.S. military, the IAEA, anybody connected with the nuclear industry, they really are so committed to this that they deny immediately radiation causes harm and underreport the negative effects by 90%. And this is what they do. Like the whole, we pass laws, our Congress and our Senate, they pass laws to help. Like they set up this act to help compensate people. But at the ground level, the corporations, the people that you're working for, basically tell you to sit down and shut up. Like just don't talk. You're a bad citizen if you start talking about having nosebleeds.
Right. Yeah, you're messing everything up here. You're running up the cost. You know, if you
Right,
start
it's your
putting on all
fault.
your protective equipment, and then other people are going to feel like they have to put on their protective equipment, and then they're going to start saying, "Well, hey, how dangerous is it out here? And maybe I need to get some hazard pay out here." And oh my goodness, now we're going to have to pay somebody a decent rate to keep them safe. It's really not that hard. You know, if somebody's supposed to be wearing a dosimeter badge, just make sure they're wearing it and actually test it correctly. Because I got to tell you, I talked to workers who they would take that badge because they, you know, people aren't dumb. You know, they would suspect, are people really testing my badge? And they would purposely heat what they call it, heating the badge up, you know, can over contaminate the badge and then send it through. And it would come right back to them. Yeah, you're good. And I thought that was horrible, right? The first person who told me that worked at the Hematite plant, which is another Mallinckrodt plant in Hematite, Missouri. That was the first. I said, "Well, that just sounds horrible, right?" But I heard it like when I went to Fanal, I heard it in different states from other workers too. So then I started to wonder how many workers were affected by that? How many people were? Because that's the whole thing with the program is they have what's called dose reconstruction, where they basically are trying to reconstruct the dose that they think you might have got back in the 40s or 50s. They don't really know, but they're guessing at it, you know, which is ridiculous anyway. But they're often guessing at it with faulty information, as Denise Brock points out in the film. You know, she says garbage in, garbage out. If they're manipulating the information that the government's looking at, they're going to come up with the wrong equation at the end and deny workers. You know, there's people, I'm going to assume that you were wearing your badge, and once you see Bill Hoppe and those guys who, when he says in the film, the only time I wore a badge is when the government came in here. And when they left, so went our badges, which is ridiculous. Now, so, you know, you look at it, the government, people are like, "Oh, government's not doing it." They've got to do their job, but private companies got to do their job too. If your workers are supposed to be wearing badges, have them wear their badges, whether the government's in there or not. It's
That's
ridiculous.
considered a cost savings plan, though. I mean, really, for them.
Profit over people.
Yeah,
Profit over people every time.
that is really the fundamental. That's the whole thesis behind nuclear. They don't care about human life. It's pretty evident. We've had 70 years of alternative facts on nuclear. I mean, it's unconscionable.
It
Tell
is.
people how you got the name of the film, The Safe Side of the Fence. That's very interesting.
Part of the credit goes to my brother because I initially was going to call the film Hot, The Legacy of Nuclear. And I was just talking to my brother on the phone one day, and he says, "Oh yeah, by the way, that you need to change that title. It's horrible." I said, "What?" It came out of the blue. He said, "Yeah, you need a more catchy title than that. That's not going to cut it." And all the way up until that point, I had never even considered. So then I started like really thinking, "Well, what can I possibly call this film?" And
What was the original title? Say it again. Hot.
it was hot because people were like saying our badges. People kept using that term as a term that people like contamination when they say, "Hey, my badge, I came up hot on my badge," you know, or
Right.
"This area is really hot," you know. So I was just going to call it just that, you know, just as hot, you know, and then with the little subtitle, the legacy of nuclear. My brother's like, that's get rid of that. And so that started me. I started me thinking.
Good title, Safe Side of the Fence.
Yeah, well, you know, the fence kept coming up throughout the film. If you watch the film, people keep referring to, like, well, the material's on this side of the fence, and it's like it's over there, and you know, it's, you know, we've got these signs up on the fence, but the ironic thing about a fence is, like, the material can, you know, float through a fence, go over a fence, get in the groundwater, go under a fence. The fence is like meaningless. And there's a scene in the
Meaningless.
film where Father Jerry Kleba is describing how everyone is on one side of the fence at the cleanup of the Weldon plant, just in their street clothes, you know, the dresses and, you know, high heels and stuff. And right on the other side of the fence are these guys with their PPE and their, like, hazmat suits on and stuff.
Right.
And he
It
would
was.
just point it out how ridiculous. And so the it in his mind, and that in that point, I just that's my favorite part of the film. And I decided to kind of call it that after his comments and Gary Ferguson's comments too. He talks about it too. They both were talking about the same situation at that site. And I think it's the perfect, it just captures the attitude, the arrogant attitude of, hey, you're safe because look, we got this fence here and the stuff is on the other side of that fence. And it's all contained over there. And you over here on this other side of the fence, you know, it's all good. Don't even worry about what's going on in that. You're safe over here, and it's just that's
It
not
is
true.
stunning. The film opens and you see a guy in a hazmat suit, and on the other side of the fence, there's his family at a picnic table, right? Like, it's just incomprehensible. Like that, you know what's incomprehensible about that is that anybody working for these corporations have the audacity to say that to people. That some human being, those words come out of their mouth. Don't worry, you're on the safe side of the fence. Like that. It's just
Right.
incomprehensible. The denial and the disregard for human life is
I think
so
that
callous.
I agree. That's also what people who are a lot of people are like, well, people didn't know back then and blah blah blah. A lot of rank and file workers did not know, but people who were supervising them, people in the scientific community, they understood the dangers of these materials, you know, and they did it anyway. Now, somebody could say, oh, well, we were at war, blah, blah, blah. You know, first of all, I don't think that's an excuse. I mean, I think you have the opportunity. In war, people make decisions all the time on their own. If someone wants to sacrifice themselves and say, I'm going to do this dangerous job, that's their choice. But I don't think somebody else has
Right.
the right to sacrifice other people. I'm going to just
Right.
sacrifice these workers here. I don't think that's right, and that's really one of the
Right.
things that really drew me into the Mallinckrodt story, because that's what I felt like what happened down there. Not just there, but I think it happened other places also. They just turned it. And then after the war ends, you know, I mean, even at Mallinckrodt, they bring in Mont Mason, the health and safety guy down there, and he immediately starts changing things and saying, "Hey, you guys gotta, you know, you got to handle the material with gloves and stuff with your bare hands. You got to do this, you got to do that." And people are like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, dude, where have you been? You know, we've been,
Right.
you should have been here 5 years ago." You
Now
know,
you tell us, right?
yeah. When I was in, I went up to Ohio and screened the film for the Fanol workers, and I went. They have a museum up there. Similar to the one that we have in St. Louis for our Weldon plant. They call it an interpretive center here. I think they may call theirs the same thing up there in Ohio. But I took a picture of a hazmat suit inside their interpretive center, their little museum for Fanol, and I posted it on Facebook, you know. And one of the workers messaged me and he says, "Yeah, I worked there for umpteen years, and then somebody comes to me one day and they say, hey, you need to be wearing this suit." And I just thought, that's just incredible. I mean, just that's the other thing. Just when I traveling around screening the film in these different cities, I'm meeting these workers. I mean, I was in South Carolina. I met two women came to my film that were in their 90s. One worked at Oak Ridge when she was 18 years old, and just listening to them, it's just like you're getting all this history right from people who were there, you know, and that's where I really also wanted to do in the film, you know, just put the camera in front of people who were there. This is what I did every day at work. This is how things were handled, you know, back then. And then I guess the other thing I wanted to do was kind of compare, you know, the 1940s to now, because if you watch the film, it starts, you know, in 1942 and comes all the way up to 2010. In the workers down at the Metropolis, the Honeywell plant in Metropolis. And so I wanted to kind of compare, you know, how different is it now? Are workers a lot safer than they were? You hope they are. And are people handling their waste a lot better than they were when they just went out in the woods and just dumped it down into a quarry, you know?
Right,
But it's
right.
really, it's we haven't come as far as I hoped that we would come. There are still workers right now working in contaminated plants right now, and as you'll see in the film, and there are people just dumping waste willy-nilly. Or as you see in the film, if they own a bunch of property and they just let the waste sit out there on their own property until it just disintegrates and goes into the ground, I guess they figure I own this property here, it's fenced off, and I'm gonna do what I want here or whatever. And until I get caught, and then I'll pay a fine that's very nominal. That's just the cost of doing business.
What's
That's what
unconscionable
happened.
about it is that nobody, none of the scientists involved in this is the thing that kept shocking me each time I've watched this, is like along the way, there had to be scientists, there had to be people who knew the danger that these everybody who was responsible for this waste, they let's just give them the benefit of the doubt. They didn't understand the gravity of their actions. Along the way, there have been scientists and people who did understand the gravity and the contamination. And nobody, I mean, the silence, the complicity is murderous, frankly. I mean, it is beyond comprehension that even to this day, the concerns of workers is minimalized. Sort of ignored. You're considered a radical if you want to talk about these things or the urgency of it. They give you lip service. This is why at all these nuclear sites, we have just waste seeping into the groundwater. I mean, it's what I've discovered is it's not just St. Louis that's completely swimming in radioactive contamination. It's most of the country, frankly.
It is, and that's we. You and I talked about that because you had asked me before, "What's the problem? Why aren't we taking it more seriously?" One of the things I wanted to do was make people understand that it's a national problem and it should be taken on that way. Because what I think is going on right now is every community is dealing with their own personal situation. Here in St. Louis, we're dealing with Westlake Landfill and Coldwater Creek, but in Colorado, they're dealing with Rocky Flats, you know. In Washington State, they're dealing with Hanford. So everybody's kind of focused on there, which I understand, because people are like, "I don't live in St. Louis. Why am I concerned about what's going on? You know, I live by Rocky Flats." And I get it. I get that. And I think it's easier for them to almost kind of like pick us off as like individual communities than like the whole us as a nation saying, "Hey, look, we have a nuclear waste problem in this country."
Exactly
You
right.
know, we need to be working together as a team. Idaho and these different, just all these different states that have all these legacy sites, and people aren't, and we're steadily creating these legacy sites, which are sites that basically that the Department of Energy has come in and has taken over and designated a legacy site that's so contaminated nobody could really live there or you know, put a business there or a home there. We have to monitor these legacy sites at a huge amount of money, at a huge cost to taxpayers forever.
Right,
Forever. I know the Weldon
forever.
plant, I think it's something like one point, they budgeted something like $1.4 million a year forever, you know. So it's the same thing with, you know, Fernald and you know, Portsmouth, Ohio, and all these different places, you know. It's just it's ridiculous. I don't think people First of all, I don't think people realize how costly it is.
Right.
You know, that's why I try to put those dots up on the screen to just kind of show, okay, here's how many they are, and you got some in your state, you know, and
That's right.
you know, here's the cost. I mean, when you start, even when you start talking about the compensation program, that's, you know, you're getting up around $12 billion that's been paid out to workers. Okay, here in the state of Missouri, paid out $200 million to workers. Those are just the workers that know about the program, that applied for the program, and actually made it through the program and got compensated. As you look at Colorado, $800 million up there. Okay, Ohio, $1 billion. Washington State, $1 billion. Tennessee, $2 billion. And so this is a lot of money just for workers who have been, which I'm sure there's more sites that are coming on, or people are applying to make their sites SEC sites, is what they call special exposure cohort sites, you know, all the time. They don't want to pay. I don't think they want to pay all these people. You know, I just don't think they want to.
This
They
is the
don't really want to.
outrageous. It didn't have to be like this, and yet they still continue with their recklessness. Like they spend so much money lying about what they're doing instead of spending money trying to remediate and stop. It's incomprehensible. It seems to be, though, the general attitude across the entire nation. Like we get this big fat lie about nuclear clean, green, and cheap. It's not cheap, it's not clean, and it's not green. I mean, it's
Exactly.
not green to have open uranium mine pits and open. Like essentially what happened in St. Louis is, I mean, we basically just put a bullet hole right in the middle, in the gut of our country. And they're not, they're just letting it bleed out. I mean, for Congress not to have taken immediate action once that fire started is incomprehensible to me. And
Yeah,
yet the people there.
I agree. I mean, it basically, first of all, I think when people become aware, one of the things I tried to do in the film was I document the misinformation from the very beginning. It begins, you know, all the way back during World War II, because of the secrecy. We're at war, we can't tell people for certain information. But what's in the film is, you know, people like Denise Brock, Denise DeGarmo, Kay Dry. These are people who did a lot of research, filed Freedom of Information Acts, and got actual documents of
Not only
the
that,
comic.
but it not just the research, they comprehend this stuff. Like I've been, this is why, like it is so intense, like for just an average citizen to have to understand how all this stuff works. And then those women, Denise Brock, Kay Dry, they've actually done the further research of figuring out how the government handles it.
Yeah. I mean, just I could not have done the film without those women. You know, they're just strong women, smart women that are just getting this. That's all really who's in my film is the women. That's not the only people that are in my film, but it really is about a lot of strong women just getting stuff done and just really working hard. And I have a woman is Jenny Welsh that does the narration in the film, and somebody asked me one day, they said, why do you have a woman doing the, not in a mean way, but they were just out of curiosity, because you usually hear a man, it's always a man narrating. And he said, you have a woman doing the narration in your film. Why'd you make that choice? And I said, because first of all, she's very good at what she does. She does a fantastic job. But also, it's really a story of strong women. So it's like, why not have a woman narrator is what I kind of figured, and I think it works, you
I
know, and
think it's
so
awesome. I think it's brilliant.
thanks.
To be
Thanks. I mean,
honest, I watched it several times, I sort of never really thought about it being a woman or not a woman, but it seems very natural to me. I really recommend that people, if you really want to understand, the thing that I really like about your documentary is it really goes to the heart of the process. The way you've sort of weaved the story interlocking with people's personal stories and the government and then the waste site, it really does show how I think that it really does show how the it's intentional. They don't really want people to get compensated. They really want you just to shut up and go away, stay on the safe side of the fence. You know what I mean? Like, they just don't want you to move forward. It's a very compelling, and the tenacity of the people of St. Louis is just amazing. And the kindness, that's the other part that really sticks out to me, is their generosity in words and attitude. Like, if it was me, I'd be spitting nails. You know what I
I
mean?
know.
Like,
I know. I know. It's something else. I mean, it just, it really that was such a part of it. I mean, for me, I mean, experience for me is really, it's really been life changing for me. I mean, it's like I felt that I enjoy covering my sports, and obviously it's profitable because people just want to tune out and watch their sports on TV, and we need entertainment, we need to be able to relax and stuff like that, and I get it. But at the same time, I was at a point in my life where it's like, well, what can I do to contribute a little bit more? And this story kind of came along, and I just kind of felt like I think I could make a difference with this story because it really, there are amazing people in the film. And even my dad, I just talked to my dad. My dad was proud of me, of course. And he said, "Son, you did a real good job with your film." He said, "But you have been blessed with amazing people in your film." I said, "I was." It's like a group of people who are incredible, and it's
yeah.
just like I just put them together. I tried to put them together in order, in a way that people can understand what the points that they were making. But at the same time, these people are amazing. And so it's the most difficult part was what to cut out, because all these people, I interviewed them for hours, and it's probably, I interviewed probably 40 something people. You can't put everything in the film, it'd be too long. And so there was so much that, I could have made three films out of this, out of the interview footage that I had by itself, because there was so much there. And I really just wanted people to be able to sit down and in less than 2 hours kind of understand this process and this history. And everybody, and when I first started, no doubt, I didn't even know if I could do it. I mean, you think, and you're talking history, a complicated government program. How can I make a film about a complicated government program, and then the science behind it? And it's like, am I going to be able to make something that doesn't put people to sleep or just make them zone out? But nobody does that in the film. Everybody gets it. They understand it. It's not like over anybody's head. They get it, and I'm really happy about that. And I'm
Well,
really happy.
let me I went to the Facebook page, and you can type into Facebook the safe side of the fence, and it'll pop up, and you can find where this is being screened. I see that it's being screened currently, like you said, on the West Coast, in Livermore, actually, where the Lawrence, isn't this where the Lawrence Livermore lab is? The
Yeah, that's
same
why I'm
little
coming there.
town?
I'm coming there for that particular lab. Yeah, the
It's
workers
going
at
to be
that lab and the
interesting to see how
history.
many of those victims are. It's going to be at the Vine Cinema in Livermore. If anybody is out in the San Francisco or the Livermore area, share this because it's going to be on March 29th. I'd love to have you back after this showing, and you can maybe share some of your experiences. I'm sure you're going to be speaking to.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure every time you do a screening, Tony, don't you actually meet new nuclear victims?
Oh yeah. Well, it's also, I just wanted to throw it. You can go to the site, thesafesideofthefence.com, and you can get a
Great.
DVD from there also. And there's links to iTunes and Amazon Prime on there, and then my other screening dates. But yes, my
Awesome.
Q and A's go for until the theater kicks us out, until the theater basically closes, because it's not the kind of film that people are. Hey, what lens did you use for that particular shot? Nobody cares about that. It's not that kind of, people are there to say, hey, this is what happened to me. I worked at this plant and I did this or whatever, blah blah blah. And it really becomes a forum for people to discuss. And there are people usually, like when I was in Colorado, or people there who were there to talk about the waste of Rocky Flats. Hey, I moved to this area and nobody told me about this, and they haven't cleaned it up, and blah blah blah. And so it really becomes like a community forum the Q&A does, and sometimes I have Denise Brock there with me, or Brian Zink, who is a lawyer who represents these workers and helps get them compensated. So when I have them there for the Q&A, it's great because I just, you know, I can really toss a lot of questions over there to them. But yeah, it's the Q&As, they go for a long time. And, you know, as a small filmmaker, when you try to come into a theater, you know, obviously these big chains make it very difficult because they're like, hey, who are you, little person from St. Louis with your little independent film? We have Star Wars and Captain America. You know, why do we want to make room for your little dinky film? And I'm like, hey, people are going to show up for my film. There's a lot of workers. And I'm only here for one day. And people care about not only just workers, people care about the environment. There's going to be a lot of people here. And believe me, you'll make your popcorn money back. And they do. You know, when I usually come in there, I crush all those Hollywood films for that because I'm coming in on a Tuesday or a Wednesday or a Thursday on a, right. You know, one day a week. And people show up big time and we have a nice crowd and we have a nice conversation afterwards. And so it's been very rewarding for everybody involved.
That's really awesome. I have to say it's a window into what has really, I think maybe this is why I've thought about this quite a bit. Maybe this is why I have such a big interest in it. To me, what happened in St. Louis and with the Manhattan Project has created this kind of Stepford Wives attitude in our country where we just don't talk about the nuclear contamination. You're expected to step in line, and yet we allow our, like I know here in Oregon, we have an open uranium pit mine that I discovered myself. There are trails up there. There's absolutely no regard to keeping people out. It's like building that fence next to a nuclear dump site is as if we're supposed to accept that that's an acceptable means. I mean, the doublespeak is just beyond comprehension. This is what your film keeps bringing it back home to a personal level with all these people and the way they talk about it was just a job and I went to work and I was expected to do this. And, you know, it was really out of their own hearts. They went and did this day after day. And when they began to get, well, maybe something was wrong, even still, they still hung on to the idea that they were going to be protected, that somebody would not let them be so harmed.
Yeah, I think it's human nature to not, you know, to not want to, you don't really think that somebody's going to do something like that to you. You want to believe that people, you know, are good and, you know, and for the most part, people are. But, you know, every once in a while, you know, somebody's not being good. Somebody's not looking out for you. And that's horrible when that happens. And, you know, it was shocking to me. I mean, when just growing up, I didn't know anything about the nuclear industry. I thought everybody was walking around in their hazmat suits all the time, talking to each other like, good morning. You know, that's what my kind of, I thought that was in my head. What I thought everyone has like these, you know, clean like rooms and stuff, you know, but it's not like that at all. They're like old buildings that are contaminated and it's, you know, they've been contaminated for years. And essentially what happens is they build a plant, they contaminate it, they tear it down and they bury it in a tomb. And then they build another one, and they do the same thing. And it's just like, that's the process. And I was like, that's crazy. And they keep working these workers in these buildings until they can finally just, okay, we just got to shut it down. We can't do anything with this building. It's so hot now. We just got to just get rid of it. It's obscene, really is.
Obscene. And this is why your film is so compelling. And really, people need to understand. And I think one of the things, this is why you won all the awards that you did. Well, we're going to have a link to your show in the podcast. We'll put a link to your website, thesafesideofthefence.com, so that people can find out more about your story and about the film and how to find it. But, you know, this whole thing is really just, it's just incomprehensible that now we've had two excellent documentaries made. you're out there promoting this film and trying to get people to understand that there is options for them if you've been a nuclear worker. There are things we can do. But still, it's deafening, the silence. I mean, I personally am quite concerned about the Trump nation. Like, we heard yesterday the new proposal is to gut the EPA by 40%, underfunded by just about 40%. We haven't even heard what they're going to do to the Department of Energy. I mean, it's going to be shocking to see that they think that they can just, it's like the days of Dickens. We're headed back to the days of Dickens, frankly.
We are.
When,
I mean, there's a lot
we
of people.
Just dump in the streets and they think, well, the little people are going to die.
Right. I mean, I think so many people have just bought into the corporate propaganda. They just really, they don't understand what the Department of Energy does in the first place. So when they say, well, we're going to go ahead and get rid of the Department of Energy, they're like, okay, get rid of it. They don't even know what it does.
Right.
They handle all this nuclear waste and their nuclear weapons and all of that.
And
they have
frankly,
no idea.
90% of the Department of Energy, 80-90% of the Department of Energy, its budget is for nuclear.
Yeah.
Its budget is for nuclear.
That's one of the things I've been trying to deal with. Like, I think the film exposes a lot of misinformation and how that misinformation came into being. And I think once you see the documents, because it's essentially, I don't have a lot of fonts on the screen in my film. It basically, what I have up, the graphics that I have up there are somebody's name and their title. Other than that, what's up on that screen are actual documents. The EPA's reports or the Atomic Energy's or someone's memos back and forth, you know, that's what's up there. That's these people's actual comments that they made, not me. And so you can read them for yourself. And if you, you know, this is what Mont Mason said, you know, to Thomas Mancuso. This is the conversations going back and forth between these people. So. This
and
freedom.
It's stunning. It is very I mean, for a person like me who's empathetic or I'm, you know, somewhat of an empath and I have all these emotions all over the outside of my being, right? Watching, this is why I've had to watch your film. Like, I've watched it, but I, to be honest, I end up crying. I still have not seen it without crying. Like, I find it very compelling how generous these people are in spirit. Even Denise Brock, the kindness, like her attitude is just very, she's strong and forceful, but really she still has a sense of American commitment to the American ideal. And, you know, instead of being flaming mad at the way people have been lied to, she still believes in our ethics, our American spirit, our American unity of, well, we're Americans and we're just going to fix this.
She's the real deal. She's the real deal. I mean, she works for workers. She works to get workers compensated every single day.
It's and she's generous.
Yeah. She's generous, and she does. She's so modest, because when I first interviewed her, it took me several months to really get my head around how much she accomplished, because she's not, you know, a person, well, you know, Tony, I've done this.
I have to cut you off. We have 15 seconds. I apologize for not watching the time. You've been listening to Lonnie Clark, The Age of Fission with Tony West, the safesideofthefence.com. Please go there. Watch his documentary. Totally awesome. I hope you'll join us again. Put your courage feet on, you guys. Be into it.